America's hard-working farmers and have lots of fun doing it. Visit ConnectingFarmToFork.com today for a learning experience that'll really grow on you. ConnectingFarmToFork.com. Brought to you by the people who care at Feedstuffs Food Link.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Hello, all. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. We would like to thank America's Web Radio for the opportunity to bring you this program this morning. With me in the studio is David Moxley, who's been kind enough to run the board this morning and be my one-man audience and be interested the entire hour. I would like to also thank the Docs for Patient Care Foundation for their support of this program. The Docs for Patient Care Foundation supports freedom of choice in healthcare. In the first segment this morning, we're going to finish up our discussion of the VA scandal, which we had started a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Schertz and myself. A lot has happened since then, so we're going to get into those things that have happened that are new. The biggest of these developments was actually very recent, less than 48 hours ago, when Senator Tom Coburn's office this past Tuesday released a VA oversight report. And to this point, you do your research and you find bits and pieces. You find a whistleblower here, a doctor coming forward there, and it's kind of all coming in small bits, and it's hard to put the whole thing together and understand the depth and the breadth and the duration that this scandal has been going on. This report puts all that to rest. This is 120 pages, including 80 pages of the most horrific medical and ethical horror stories that you can possibly imagine. It, as a physician, it's emotionally draining to read this report, and I just got my hands on it last night, so I haven't had a chance to comprehensively review all 120 pages. So I'll beg your forgiveness in advance if this is a little bit disorganized, but I tried to go through this and sort of, you know, pick up the high points. Beginning with the part that everybody knows about, which is this falsification of appointment wait times, bureaucrats fudging the system to make things look like vets are getting appointments within 2 weeks, but in reality they're having to wait weeks and months for the appointment. And some folks who support big government have suggested that, that this is an isolated thing. There's a few people here and there that have done this, and those people need to be punished, but basically the big government supporters continue to say that the VA overall works fine. Well, this report puts that notion to rest. The falsification of appointment time records is occurring at 70% of all VA facilities. That's over 100 hospitals and clinics across the country. And it turns out the deeper you get into this report, you know, every page just makes your jaw drop. It's incredible. It turns out that maybe this appointment scheduling snafu is the least of their sins. Over the past decade, there's been 1,000 vets that have died from VA malfeasance, and there's been over $1 billion in malpractice claims paid over that decade. If you think that the wait list concept at the VA is a new thing, well, it turns out that's not true either. Wait lists at the VA go back as far as 1932. They were also documented in 1946, so this begins before World War II. We actually get numbers starting in 1955 when the wait list was 16,000 veterans. And 1958, it was 25,000 veterans. That was the high in 1963. It dropped a little bit to 19,000. But then the next numbers in the report come from 2003, where there were 110,000 vets waiting for their first appointment with a primary care doctor. And you might think, well, some people say, well, it's only a matter of access. Once you get in the system, it's great. We just have little problem getting people into the system. Once they get there, though, oh, well, the care is great. It's high efficiency. It's low cost. It's all those things. Well, it turns out that's not true either. Even if you get an appointment, you see your primary care physician, you talk about your health issues, and let's say that, as commonly happens, you need some tests. Right? You need some blood work. You need an X-ray. You need a colonoscopy. And so an order gets put in, the primary doc writes on a piece of paper or enters into a computer system, you need something, you need some tests. Well, what happens then? Well, it turns out it's not so good then either, because those orders sit on a wait list for another 3 to 6 months, and after that, the wait list gets too long, and it gets the attention of some bureaucrat who says, well, We don't want long wait lists because that makes us look bad. That endangers our pay-for-performance bonuses. So what happens? The order gets erased. The order gets purged. Documentation of millions of orders for medical tests canceled just so the backlogs look good to the central planning folks in Washington who have nothing to evaluate except these artificially generated pay-for-performance reports. So it's a small wonder then that at a VA hospital here in Georgia over the years 2011 and 2012 that over 5,000 veterans were denied colonoscopies who needed them. Most of those were screening colonoscopies, to be sure, but some of those were diagnostic colonoscopies ordered because of a symptom, such as, say, passing blood. Or they were surveillance colonoscopies, meaning a problem had already been discovered that urgently needed to be followed up, never got followed up. And so once you get in the system, things don't work well for you, and you're still fighting the bureaucrats every single step of the way in a culture that sees the VA as a cash cow or a way to live high on the hog on government money rather than emphasizing the most important thing, which is the care of the patient. And so it comes as no surprise that the veterans waiting around for treatment have a rather morbid slogan. They call it delay, deny, deceased. Delay, deny, deceased. Sad. Very sad. You think you've heard enough? Well, as they say on late night TV, wait, there's more. Waste. Billions and billions of dollars of waste in the VA. The statistics, again, from the Coburn Report are astounding. Right? While veterans languish waiting for care, the VA spends an average of $225 million a year just on office remodeling and furniture. Lavish remodeling of administrative offices, nothing for the clinics, certainly nothing for the patients. Travel expenses, meetings. There were two training meetings in Orlando in the same year. The total cost for two training meetings, $6.1 million. Right? A lavish meeting held at a resort for 40 people for 10 days cost over $300,000. Buying stuff like karaoke machines and entertainment videos. And I'm not talking training videos that were there to help the purpose of the meeting. We're talking video parodies. We're talking smiley face videos, whatever that is. Ridiculous stuff. Wasted money. And somehow, in spite of all that wasted money, the VA still manages to leave over $30 billion per year average on the table unspent. So I don't understand how the supporters of big government can defend the VA and say, well, the wait lists are because the VA is overwhelmed. When they don't have enough money, we need to give them more. Well, they're not spending what they already have, and what they are spending, a huge proportion of it, they're wasting. You heard enough yet? Well, we're not finished. And again, I'm just picking out the highlights. I'm picking out the highlights of 120 pages of information, including dozens of pages of references that back this stuff up. How about criminal behavior? How about absolute criminal behavior? And some of the stuff in here will curl your hair. I almost am afraid to say some of it on the air, so I'm going to kind of highlight it and just go from 50,000 feet. But we're talking sexual misconduct, not only to employees but to patients, including physicians, guilty of misconduct during examinations. We're talking intentional identity theft. I don't know how you do this. I don't know how you look a veteran in the eye, someone who laid their life on the line to protect our freedom and our liberty, and you deliberately steal their identity and sell it to somebody for drugs. It's documented in the Coburn Report. I just don't know how you do all that stuff. This report, if you feel like you know all there is to know about the VA scandal, take a couple of hours. It's going to take that long, maybe longer. Read through this report, and you tell me what you think, because I don't know how you defend the VA or think that it can be saved with a culture of corruption this deep and this widespread. But we do have some response from the supporters of big government defending the VA in the face of all this. Paul Krugman wrote an article in the New York Times on the 19th of this month entitled Veterans and Zombies. Great title. And it's a classic example of how supporters of big government will duck and move and dive and defend themselves in the face of overwhelming evidence against their position. So they have two – there's two dodges in this article. One is change the subject, and the other is repeat the lie. So first he changes the subject. He says, yes, there's a scandal at the VA. Well, that's no big deal. It's overblown. What we really need to talk about is, and I quote, the surreal inefficiency, and injustice of the American health system as a whole. And then he totes out the same tired, inaccurate arguments to bash the overall healthcare system as a whole, using the ridiculous parameters of life expectancy and infant mortality as a measure of the performance of an entire healthcare system. Now, I don't want to go too deep into that. You could spend a whole show talking about why those measurements don't make sense, but I'm just going to give you a couple of points. The first regarding life expectancy. Life expectancy is not a measure of how a healthcare system performs. Life expectancy is a measure of how patients perform, how people perform. So when I go to the doctor and he tells me that I'm 25 pounds overweight and I need to lose weight, and I say, yep, that's right, well, I'll go home, I'll exercise, I'll diet, and I need to do that. And yet every day I go home and, you know, I can't resist the Oreo cookie ice cream, and I can't resist the crackers and the hummus and all the good stuff that's out there to eat. That's not my doctor's fault. That's not the healthcare system's fault. That's my fault. That's my problem. That's not my doctor's problem. You can't hold my doctor responsible for this. You can't hold the healthcare system responsible for the bad habits, the bad diet, the overweight, driving cars too fast, all the things that we do to shorten our lives. The healthcare system does not bear a responsibility for what patients do. So I don't buy the idea of life expectancy. The other component of life expectancy, without getting too far off topics, is the genetics. If you have a genetic tendency for heart disease or some other disease, again, we don't currently have the technology to fix those things, and you can't hold the healthcare system responsible for those. Infant mortality. Well, that only measures a sliver of the healthcare system. That measures access to perinatal care, it measures access to prenatal care, and I'm not saying those aren't valid measurements for some parts of the healthcare system, but as an ear, nose, and throat doctor like myself, you know, I might be a great doctor, or I might be an awful doctor, or I might have a great practice or a terrible practice, but it's not going to impact the infant mortality rate. And that doesn't measure how we treat heart disease in adults. It doesn't measure how well we treat pneumonia. It doesn't measure how well we treat adult cancers. It measures a tiny sliver of the healthcare system. So I'm getting kind of tired of this kind of bashing of the healthcare system based on statistics that don't have any substance relative to what you're really trying to measure. They sound good, and you know, your average person on the street understands those ideas well, but they just don't make sense. The only thing Mr. Krugman says about the VA is to say, well, and I quote, until the scandal broke, until this brand new thing just came out a few weeks ago, all indications were that the VA was working well, providing high quality care at low cost. So in other words, as long as we were blissfully ignorant of the whole thing, everything was fine. Sure, ignorance is bliss. Everything was fine until, you know, we finally learned the truth. Well, it turns out it's not fine, and there's plenty of data in the Coburn Report to prove that it's not fine. The wait lists arise partly because of too much demand, not enough resources. Well, the Coburn Report puts that to rest pretty easily. So after changing the subject, he repeats the lie. All right, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Pay no attention to 80 pages of VA horror stories. Pay no attention to all these things that you're hearing that are all substantiated fact. You just listen to me because I know. And I'm telling you that the VA works well, that healthcare reform is working well. Repeat the lie enough, and it becomes the truth. So we could argue about this all day, right? Nothing that I say or anyone else on our side of the argument against big government is going to say is going to convert the big government supporters. They'll keep repeating the lie to themselves and to each other and to their base, and that's fine. And we will keep doing the same to ours for the truth. But I have a challenge, right? Let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's let the others put our money where their mouth is. And let's come up with a system that allows the veterans to choose. They can go to the VA, or give them a choice. Give them a chance to go somewhere else. We're at the break. You're listening to America's Web Radio.
Spring is in the air, literally. So follow Sniffles to Atlanta Center for breathing easy. Weeds, spores, grass, pollen. Airborne allergen levels are through the roof, putting your allergies into overdrive. It's time to followsniffles.com.
Follow me and breathe easy.
End your annual ritual of taking medication to alleviate facial pressure, facial pain, congestion, and headaches by treating the problem, not the symptom. Balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for. This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day. Followsniffles.com.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Your severe sinus and nasal symptoms gone once and for all. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again. Call us at 404-591-9100. That's 404-591-9100.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Followsniffles.com.
This is Michael Gannett with the Middle East Research Center Limited, bringing you insight to Israel, the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security, every Sunday at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am Dr. Mike Karuchak, and thank you for listening. We're going to go on to the next segment now. We spent the first segment talking about the scandal at the VA, and our conclusion there was, Let's lay down a challenge for the big government supporters. Let's give the veterans a chance to choose. If they get stuck on a wait list, let's give them somewhere else to go. Then none of that stuff matters. Now we're going to talk about something very different. We're going to have a very different change of topic here. We're going to begin a bunch of segments here on health information technology. And this is a topic that that I am very passionate about. But I want to make a couple of introductory comments before we get deep into it. The first is that this is not going to be some kind of nerdy, geeky conversation about bits and bytes and hardware and software and tablets and laptops and all of that. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is if you go to your average doctor's lounge where, you know, as we speak, doctors are gathering for a cup of coffee or a donut or breakfast to chat with each other before they go and start their day, you're not going to hear that kind of conversation. You're not going to hear people talking about technical stuff and hardware and software and laptops and all that kind of stuff. When they talk about health information technology and the frustrations that they face, the conversation is very different. So the things that we are going to talk about today are the things that doctors are talking about today. You're going to hear me doing a lot of criticizing of information technology. You're going to hear me criticize the health IT industry. You're going to hear me criticize the broad overreach of government. But before we get too deep into that, you need to know a little bit about where I'm coming from here and the experience that we have had in our practice regarding health information technology, because we have had a very, very positive experience with our system, and we're coming up on 10 years of experience. We, as a practice at Ear, Nose, and Throat of Georgia, committed to electronic medical records back in 2004. And after going through a long selection and implementation process, we went live with that system for the first time in about the mid portion of 2005. Back then, the landscape in health information technology was very different, right? There was no government overreach. There were no incentive programs. We were able to freely choose to have an EMR or stick with paper. There was no pressure. There were no issues. And that timing gave us the opportunity to experience health information technology for about 5 years without government interference. And then meaningful use programs, the government overreach came along, and we have had the opportunity to experience 5 years with the heavy presence of government. And that has given us a very unique opportunity to compare and contrast those two sets of conditions. So we're going to talk about that. A couple of other comments about my own personal experience here. I am a full-time practicing physician. I spend virtually all of my available professional time caring for patients. I have the usual background, 4 years of medical school, 7 years of residency and fellowship. That's the medical piece. On the information technology piece, I've been working with health information technology for almost 40 years, since the 1970s. And for my practice, I lead the effort in electronic medical records and health information technology. And as part of that effort, I actually write code for our practice's EMR. And you won't find too many docs that do that. So I get to spend a lot of time, full-time professional time, on the healthcare side, taking care of patients, and on the information technology side, writing code, talking to our IT vendors, speaking their language, which gives me a unique view of both sides of the fence. And believe me, those are very, very different worlds, and we're going to talk about how different those worlds really are and the problems that that creates. So my conclusion, based on my own experience and the experience of our practice, and this is important to remember when I go into all the criticisms, is that health information technology, electronic medical records, properly done, or at least close, I think we've done a very good job in our practice, not perfect by any stretch, but if it's well done, it works very, very well. Right? We have enjoyed an excellent return on our investment. Right? It's a constant battle to make it work, but it's been very good for us, and I don't think anyone would suggest going back. It works well when it's done right. The problem is, with the government interference that we've had over the last 5 or 6 years, the whole situation's been ruined. It has forced a system-wide macro-level implementation that has been nothing short of a disaster. And so most practices have implemented EMR not under the free choice conditions that we did, but under the stressed, incentivized, threatened penalty environment of government regulations and incentive and penalty programs. So while the concept of health information technology and electronic medical records is a great concept, shows great promise, the current situation is an absolute mess. And the reason that it's an absolute mess is because over the past several years, there has been the formation of what I can best describe as an unholy alliance between the government and vendors that sell health IT products. 5 years ago, this relationship produced a body of regulations that has forced physicians and hospitals to purchase and use health IT electronic medical record products that are not well developed enough to be safe for patient care, to be efficient for doctors to use. These products just, quite frankly, are not ready for prime time. So how do we know that? Well, I can give you some information that backs up this point of view. Last November, late 2013, there was a survey released by Medical Economics. This was a survey of 967 physicians polled in the latter portion of 2013, basically asking them, how do you like your EMR? Here's what we learned. 70%, 7 out of 10 physicians using an electronic medical record did not feel that their EMR investment was worth the cost and worth the effort. And that same number, about 73%, would not repurchase an EMR if they had the chance to do it all over again. 69%, about the same number, you know, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters, report that quality of care was not improved, coordination of care was not improved, and a significant number, 45%, almost half, felt that their electronic medical record system actually made patient care worse, not better. A similar proportion, two-thirds, 66%, reported that their EMR cost them money, that they had financial losses, mostly related to a decrease in productivity because the electronic medical record system is such a administrative and workflow burden. And 38%, about a third, reported very significant financial losses, probably bad enough to adversely affect the doctor's own personal income. The most common complaint about these electronic medical record systems, again, about that same two-thirds ratio, said that it was a lack of system functionality. Right? The bottom line is the folks that are writing these systems come from a universe that is completely removed from healthcare, the information technology universe. They don't understand the field that they're writing programs to run, and so they're very cumbersome. They're very difficult to use. Right? Most of these folks writing this software have never been in a doctor's office to understand how healthcare works and how their product is going to be used. I don't see how you write a product to automate a process that you've never seen and that you don't understand. And yet that's where we are. And we're finally getting some data now, and here's another study to consider, that documents that EMR can be hazardous to your health and can hurt patient care. This was an article published this past Friday, June 20th. Again, very hot off the press from, this is kind of a mouthful, here we go, the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association. This was a study of a large institution's electronic medical record system. They looked at 100 events. They called them closed investigations of issues. This included adverse events that happened, right? Harm to patients as a result of the electronic medical record system, things they call near misses. I think we know what that means, something that was caught in the nick of time just before it hurt a patient, and potential events that were or issues with the information technology system that had potential to do harm but were caught before there was any problem that happened. Most of these problems had to do with the fact that these systems are poorly designed. Their displays where they put data up on a screen for a provider to review were confusing. They were incomplete. Right? And that makes sense. Right? Display technology has only been around a few decades. Paper technology has been around thousands of years. And so, you know, the ability for paper to display everything that a provider needs to know is far better than a computer display being able to display everything that a provider needs to know. And so this is the problem that we have. The public assumes they have been sold a bill of goods on information technology. Their assumption is that this stuff reduces errors when it really doesn't. It just replaces errors that we're familiar with errors that we're not familiar with. Does not improve efficiency. It makes things worse. It doesn't improve productivity. It makes it worse. There may be some improvements in patient safety, but those come at the expense of other things that can hurt patients. And so this is what we're going to talk about in a little more detail in the next couple of segments. And when segment three begins in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about the lessons of history. How did we get from a pretty good situation in 2008 to a situation in 2014 where we are really up against it in terms of making these things work well. And we will talk about a sharp contrast between a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2008 where providers who were using an electronic medical record were very happy in 2008 with where things were versus where we are now in 2014, where the vast majority of providers are unhappy with where we are under the threat of incentives and financial penalties. So we're coming up on the hard break. Let me put an invitation out to you. If you like what you hear or you have suggestions, we're looking for topics for shows in the future, but please let me hear from you. The email is doctorslounge, that's all one word, .webradio@gmail.com. Coming up on the break, you are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
This is Cheryl Linker, host of the Master Gardener Hour on America's Web Radio, Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. Join us as we keep things fun and interesting as we educate you in the world of master gardening.
This is Michael Gano with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory, ladies serving 2 years and men serving three right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training. In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Gano. Thank you, God bless Patriot conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We are back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Before we get into the next segment, I'm going to issue the email invitation again because I'm getting some feedback that I need to say the address twice. We'll keep this email for the next week or so, and then we are going to switch to another one. But for today, for right now, please email me with your thoughts, suggestions. You agree with me, you disagree with me, you like it, you don't like it, at Doctor's Lounge. That's all one word, no apostrophes, no interruptions. doctorslounge.webradio@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. In the next segment, we're going to talk about how we got to where we are in health information technology. As we've discussed in the prior segments, things are a mess right now. We have a situation where under government threat of financial harm, that doctors have been coerced and forced into buying products that aren't quite ready for prime time, that don't work so well, and don't live up to the IT utopian promise of complete elimination of shortcomings and total perfection. So let's talk about how we got there. And to understand that, you've got to turn the clock back several years to about 2008, 6 years back. And, you know, in IT terms, in computer terms, that's like decades because of how fast things move. But back then, a special article was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that was a survey of 2,700 physicians asking them, do you use an EMR? Do you not use an EMR? If you do use an EMR, do you like it? Do you not like it? Do you think it helps your practice? Does it help your patients? And if you don't use an EMR, then why don't you use an EMR? What is it that you don't like about health information technology and electronic medical records that's keeping you from making that step? So what did we find? Well, the study found that the rate of use of what they call a fully featured EMR was only 4%. So out of 100 doctors, only 4 doctors were using a system that met the study criteria for a full featured electronic medical record system. Very small proportion of doctors. But among those 4% of physicians, the satisfaction rate for EMR users was 93%. That's an astounding number. 93% of that small 4% fraction was happy with that electronic medical record system. And if you drill down to some more specific questions, 82% felt that it improved their medical decision making. 92%, another astounding proportion, felt that it improved communication with other providers. And 86% felt that it reduced medication errors from the electronic prescription piece of that system, no doubt. Among the other physicians, the non-EMR users, the non-users of a fully featured EMR, why did they not want an electronic medical record? Well, they cited things that you would expect, the cost of the system. They were not sure, related to cost, after they spent all that money, that they would get a return on investment. And they were concerned about the loss of productivity while they were getting this system up on board, that they would be slaves to the system and that it would get so much in the way that they couldn't do their job, which is to take care of patients and not enter data on a screen. And that makes perfect sense to me if you think about it, because a independent private medical practice has to shell out the money for this electronic medical record system, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking a great deal of money. This is something that they have to get their return on investment in. They have to get that money back and at least break even, because if you're going to spend that kind of money and not get your money back out of it, you're going to go bankrupt. You can't tolerate $50,000, $100,000 per physician to get a system up and running if you're not going to get that money back. I mean, this is the financial reality. So let's just think about that study for a minute. Now, in medicine, when we evaluate a research paper that gets published, there are levels of validity regarding experimental evidence. The highest level of data validity is the highest level of data validity is what we call a prospective randomized controlled studies. These are very, very carefully designed studies. They involve biostatisticians and all kinds of things to be sure that the measurements that you get are accurate and free of bias and are as valid as they can be. That's level one. That's the best. At the other end of the scale is level five, which has absolutely no scientific planning or statistical numbers to it at all. It's just called expert opinion. And that's basically what this survey is. This is an opinion, a survey of expert opinions. It's aggregated expert opinions. So it's a very interesting study, and I think it's valid for what it attempts to do. It's important to realize as I go forward with the next idea here that this is the lowest form of experimental data. So if this was any other sort of medical intervention, any other kind of change proposed to the practice of medicine, whether this was a new drug or a new procedure, a new operation, a new diagnostic tool, the only conclusion that you could draw from a study like this is that it needs further study. It merits further study. And if you, 90% of the papers you read, somewhere in the conclusion, it's going to say this issue needs further study. And in fact, in defense of the authors of this paper, that's exactly what they say in the last paragraph. Needs further study. No one in good conscience would suggest, based on a study like this, that we should change the behavior of the entire practice of medicine based on one study that consists of the lowest form of experimental data, right? If this were a drug, if we had a drug, let's say in my field, we had an antibiotic that treats ear infections, and we surveyed doctors and found that of everybody who could use this antibiotic, only 4% of doctors actually use this antibiotic. The only ones that use it like it, but the other 96% don't. If somebody took that data and drew a conclusion that this drug is great and we want every physician to use this drug on every patient that walks through the door with an ear infection, we're going to make the other 96% use this drug, that would be regarded as ludicrous. It'd be regarded as malpractice. It'd be a terrible thing. No one would suggest changing the entire practice of medicine based on one study with the lowest form of experimental data. Unless you're the government. And this article is conveniently timed and conveniently placed to fit your agenda. And your agenda is to coerce physicians to start using electronic medical records as a Trojan horse method of gaining control of the practice of healthcare. You use this article as academic cover, and you can say on your website at hhs.gov, based on scientific studies, we're going to start an incentive penalty program to force virtually every doctor in the United States to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and radically change the practice of medicine, right? This is even worse than the drug example. The drug example of an antibiotic for ear infections, that only affects patients with one diagnosis, ear infections. This, electronic medical records, affects every single doctor and every single patient that walks through the door, regardless of what their diagnosis is. So they accept the opinions of the 4% of the doctors who like EMR. They ignore the opinion of the 96% of physicians who have serious misgivings about electronic medical records and health information technology. And they create something called the Meaningful Use Program, or HITECH, And this is not a part of Obamacare. This is a part of the stimulus bill that was passed before Obamacare. Never, never in the history of medicine has its practitioners been forced to change how they practice medicine in such a broad global scale. Never has the practice of medicine been so widely and so radically changed based on so little data. Typically, when we're contemplating a new drug, a new medical device, a new procedure, what are we looking for? What's the FDA looking for? We're looking for safety and we're looking for efficacy, right? We want a treatment that works and we want a treatment that doesn't hurt patients, that doesn't have some intrinsic problem with it that carries a significant risk to patients. All that was ignored. Nobody talked about safety and efficacy. There is no decent safety and efficacy data out there for health information technology products, and yet caution was thrown to the wind. Now, let's go back and look at that New England Journal study from a slightly different angle, because there's one other thing I want you to extract from this. You have 4% of physicians who use EMR and really like it, right? 93% satisfaction rate. You have the rest of the physicians, 90-some-odd percent, who not only don't have an EMR but really don't like the idea. The interesting thing here is that there was nobody in the middle. There was nobody who said, yeah, you know, EMR's great. You know, we just haven't gotten around to it yet. Yeah, we, you know, darn, that's a great idea. We just, you know, we're busy and we just, you know, we'll talk about that. Yeah, we think EMR is great. The people who don't have EMR were adamantly opposed to it. And the people who had EMR, there's a huge divide between those two groups. And there's a reason for that I believe. And this is what I want you to think about. And this gets back to our personal experience. When we made the commitment to be in that 4%, which was what we did in 2004, when we got together at ENT of Georgia as a group, we sat around the table and we said, in effect, we're going to be a part of that 4%. Now, why would we do such a thing? Well, it was because we had a vision. We had a vision. We saw the potential for information technology to radically improve healthcare if properly done. That was unique, right? 4%. The other thing we had is we had the collective will and we had the IT expertise and background to muscle our way through this. We understood that out of the box, these systems are practically useless. We understood it was going to take hundreds, maybe thousands of hours of uncompensated time working on these systems to customize them, to write additional code, to take these diamonds in the rough and hammer them into shape and take a product that, you know, when you first plug it in and load it in your server and turn it on is pretty much useless and turn this into something that actually serves a purpose and you create a situation where the machines serve the patients and the doctors and not the other way around. We understood that and we accepted that proposition. Now, very few practices are willing to do that. The other 96 looked at the same set of parameters that look, we don't have the resources. We're going to wait this out. We're not early adopter practices. We're going to wait until the early adopters like our practices kind of work all the bugs out, and then we'll jump in. So what should have happened in 2008 is that healthcare providers, that 4%, should have partnered, or rather the vendors should have reached out. The IT vendors should have reached out to that 4% market share they had, right? If they're competing with paper, they got a 4% market share. They should have reached out and said, we're gonna work with you. We need to know how to bring value to our products. We want you, our 4% customer base, to help us bring value to our products so that the other 96% can freely choose to buy these systems. We need you to help us make them better. Instead, that's not what happened. Right? Had that happened, we would have had a nice, slow evolutionary growth in healthcare. Instead, we had something very different. And we'll get into exactly what happened instead of what should have happened in the next segment.
Certification. Do you know why becoming a certified healthcare consumerism specialist is more important than ever in 2014? Adding this specialized designation to your credentials tells employers or your clients that you understand how much our industry has changed and how to navigate that change successfully. IHC University's certification program offers coursework both online and live at their biannual forum conference series, and testing is completed online. Reaffirm your position as a leader in the health and benefit management industry. Download our certification overview and learn more at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
Hi, this is Kate Copsey inviting you to listen year-round to America's Homegrown Veggie Show every Saturday at 10 a.m.
Today's consumers find themselves faced with a greater variety of choices than ever before, both in the food they eat and the information they receive about that food. Feedstuffs FoodLink was created to provide you with a balanced source of information for making decisions about your family's balanced diet. Visit FeedstuffsFoodLink.com to learn about your food directly from the source, the people who work every day to provide it. FeedstuffsFoodLink.com, connecting farm to fork.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We are back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am Dr. Mike Karuchek, and I am very glad that you are here with me today. All right. We're going to pick up where we left off. We were talking about the history of health information technology in America, and we had talked about what was going on in 2008, where only 4% of providers had an EMR, but boy, those 4% really liked it. And the other 96% who didn't have EMR were very adamantly against the idea for some very valid reasons. And we were to the point where the early adopter practices such as ours, we were in that 4%, and we were ready to partner with our vendor. And this gets into a short personal story here. When it was about 2008, we had had 3 years experience with our electronic medical record system, and we were feeling confident that we had conquered most of the initial startup problems after a whopping 3 years, and felt like it was time for us to share what we had learned with other practices in our specialty, in ear, nose, and throat, otolaryngology. So I went to our EMR vendor, and I said, I think it's time. Let's talk about how to make your product better for ENTs, or at least talk about how to customize it. And again, I was writing code to modify this system because our particular EMR allows you to do that, to write code, modify the system, and make a ear, nose, and throat doctor-specific product. I thought the time had come. This is exactly what I was talking about at the end of the last segment, where the vendors should have reached out to us, the 4% early adopters, and said, what can we do? Well, I decided not to wait. I reached out to our vendor, and I said, here's what I would like to do. Their response was, we're sorry. We can't help you. We can't talk to you. I said, well, why? That's kind of odd. You know, you'd be financially incentivized to make a better product and sell to a segment you're not selling to now. What's the problem? Well, the problem is we have this new government program called Meaningful Use. And since this has come out, we have all hands on deck getting our product ready to be meaningful use compliant. So we basically have all our resources devoted to that, and we just don't have time to talk to you right now. I said, well, okay, I can wait a few weeks, a few months. How long is this going to take? The answer was, we don't know how long this is going to take. I mean, this could take months. This could take years. So, you know, we can't even tell you when it is that we want to talk to you. And, you know, I left that kind of shocked, but it turns out that that's exactly what was happening, you know, everywhere across the country. Instead of letting free market forces do their job in 2008, let the vendors partner with the successful users and cause these products to slowly improve, slowly evolve, that would have created a nice, stable growth situation. Right, it wouldn't have been explosive growth, but it would have been steady growth, and it would have allowed the growth of the use of EMR to evolve in partnership with the improvement of the products. You would have had gradual change, gradual adoption, relative to stability, a situation that is far more economically feasible for physicians, far safer for patients. Unfortunately, just like my own personal story attests, that never happened. Instead, the large IT vendors, names that you would recognize, many of whom make a habit of writing big donations to politicians, partnered with these same politicians to add a section to the stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, called HITECH. Right, another lovely acronym. HITECH has a section in it called the Meaningful Use Program. And this is a program that not only incentivizes and mandates through penalties the use of electronic medical records, but also is acting like a Trojan horse, if you will, and using the EMR as a vehicle to begin the process of government control of how your doctor is going to take care of you. So in the short term, this incentive program, with incentive on the front end, penalties on the back end in the form of reduced payments, gave the IT folks exactly what they wanted. They got explosive growth in the electronic medical records market over a short time. So they went from a market share of 4% to a market share this year of well over 50%. Right now, of the approximately 1 million so-called eligible providers under meaningful use, over 500,000 of those providers now have attested to meaningful use. They've purchased an electronic medical record, plugged it in, got it running, and have jumped through the government hoops to get their meaningful use incentive payments. And, of course, the government takes this and puts on their HHS.gov website to say, oh, this is great. Doctors have finally realized the potential for technology to improve patient safety, reduce paperwork, improve efficiency, all these wonderful things. Well, it turns out that's not true. The only reason that there's a growth in market share is because if you put a big enough carrot in front of somebody and a big enough stick behind them, you know, you're going to get movement. You're going to get these things to purchase. There's a coercion going on here. And now all of this, these 96% of practices now have been forced to buy EMR against their will, right? Back in 2008, when the New England Journal study was done, it was a freedom of choice situation. And the folks that didn't have electronic medical records really, really didn't want them for perfectly valid reasons. And now the incentive program, the meaningful use program, has forced them to purchase electronic medical records against their judgment. Right? You don't believe me? Look at the numbers again. Right? In 2008, we had a 93% satisfaction rate. In 2013, the medical economic study, the satisfaction rate is 30%. So in 6 years, the satisfaction rate drops from 90% to 30%. Right? The proportion of providers that believe EMR improves quality of care has fallen from 82% in 2008 to 35% in 2013. And it turns out that the non-EMR users from the 2008 survey, what did they not like? Cost, return on investment, drop in efficiency. What do you see in terms of the adverse results from the medical economic study? That's exactly what you see. You see coordination of care is not improved, quality of care is not improved, financial losses, lack of return on investment, loss of productivity. All of those things that the non-users in the 2008 survey were afraid of came to pass, and the medical economic study demonstrates that very clearly with very good numbers. So what do we do? Well, I don't know. I've spoken with many of these physicians, these folks that have been coerced. They're not early adopters. They don't share the vision of those 4% of us that did this early on, nor should they have to. Right? Not everybody is an early adopter. These folks are unhappy. They're cynical. It doesn't matter what the potential for EMR is because they're forced to adopt it under very, very adverse conditions. So that's fine. EMR vendors got what they wanted. They got explosive growth in the market. They're all rolling in dough because they got a stimulus package. This is really what they got. This had nothing to do with quality of care. The health IT industry needed a stimulus package, and they got it. So for the last 5 or 10 minutes or so, we're going to talk about where we stand, what we do about it. We're going to talk about the culture war that exists between healthcare and the IT industry. So think about for a minute where health IT is coming from as they approach healthcare. Over the past 20 years, right, no one can deny that the health IT industry has done very nice, very great, helpful things with other parts of the economy. Right, you look at airlines. Right, 20 years ago, you wanted a ticket, you had to make a phone call, wait on hold, get somebody there, and all they were doing was reading a computer screen and reading it to you, and you're trying to make a reservation. It made perfect sense to get the human being out of the loop and let you look at your own reservation screen. And so, you know, the online reservation capability of airlines, great thing. Works very well. Grocery stores, another big industry, similar things. Barcode scanners, inventory control, price updates, banks. We have online banking. We have all kind of stuff. So the IT people are kind of cocky. They've done great with other parts of the economy, and they see the healthcare industry as very low-hanging fruit. They see all of the inefficiency, the paper records, all this thing, and all they want to do is get in there and automate the whole thing. And that vision is good except for a couple of very fatal flaws. The first is that they're so enamored with their technology, they think it's perfect, and they don't acknowledge that there's any potential for errors in a computer-driven healthcare world. Let's take electronic prescriptions as a prime example. You know, that's been a huge point of contention for the health IT folks. They hate paper prescriptions. Years ago, I went to a meeting and I talked to a health IT person who said they were bragging about this. They said that as soon as their doctor pulled out a paper prescription, they walked out. I said, well, if my doctor can't handle, you know, electronic prescriptions, I'm not going there. And this was a long time ago. This was 5-6 years ago. This was before meaningful use. So this stuff wasn't as ubiquitous as it was now. So they harp on bad doctors' handwriting, all the errors that come from handwritten prescriptions. Well, here's a little news flash for the folks that feel that way, is that the electronic prescription system is not error-free. And it's just as easy to click the wrong box or click the wrong drug off a tiny little drop-down list as it is to handwrite something that's hard to read. And the scary part that nobody realizes except doctors and people who touch patients for a living is that you're replacing an error that we're familiar with, like bad doctor's handwriting. It's been a cliche for decades. We get it, right? If a pharmacist looks at a prescription they can't read, they immediately recognize it as a problem and they know exactly what to do. They call the doctor's office and they say, what is it that you were looking to prescribe? With an electronic prescription, you don't have that potential to recognize it. It comes through as a nice, neat electronic file. And if by accident, you know, I wanted to put a patient on amoxicillin and I accidentally clicked a drug that's near it alphabetically, like let's say amiodarone, right, very close alphabetically, totally different, highly potent heart drug. You wouldn't want to mix those two up, but that'll come to the pharmacist as a nice, neat electronic prescription. They got no way to pick up the mistake. And it happens. I just read yesterday about an inpatient who was accidentally prescribed 40 times the appropriate dose of an antibiotic because the input field was entered in error. And we'll get into that next week. We're getting close to the end, but we're going to talk about, we're going to finish this topic at for the first segment when I am back in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much for listening. We are at the end of the hour. You have been in the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thanks very much. Have a good day.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, host of Detailing Addiction and medical director of the Atlanta Healing Center. Please join me on Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m.
Who is or what is USJF? It is a nonprofit legal organization founded to protect our rights through the U.S. Constitution. Active in educating the public, USJF has also contributed directly and indirectly to legal defense efforts in many celebrated cases involving fundamental conservative principles. Cases of note include the Mount Soledad Cross case, the Arizona immigration law case, the Obama eligibility cases, the NDAA illegal detention issue, and many more. Help this nonprofit as they help you. Visit www.usjf.net today.
Cook Immigration Partners is your passport through the immigration maze. Whether it's help with E-Verify in your business, or help in how to document a new employee under the new I-9 rules, or if you marry a foreign national, Cook Immigration Partners is your best choice for a legal advocate. Call us today at 866-286-6200. That's 866-286-6200, or visit us on the web at www.immigration.net.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m.